is Northfield Outdoors, brought to you by Professional Pride Realty. From hunting to hiking, camping to cooking, mushroom hunting to motorcycling, and so much more, your hosts, Dave Vesladol and Andy Beham, will enlighten, entertain, and inform you with a lively mix of guests and discussion on all things outdoors. And now your hosts, Dave and Andy.
Well, welcome to another edition of Northfield Outdoors on KYMN 95.1, The One, and 1080 AM. As always, Northfield Outdoors is proud to be sponsored by Professional Pride Realty. I'm Dave Vesladol, and alongside me, as always, Andy Beham.
Hey, Dave, how we doing?
It's winter still.
It's still winter. It is. I don't think it's going anywhere anytime soon.
Nope. We've got all of the sportsman shows coming up, planning spring fishing trips, fall hunting trips, so we got to get those going.
We just got to hope that this warm January doesn't mean our spring fishing trips are on ice.
I'd like to see a little more ice this winter. I'm tired of the rain, quite frankly.
Yeah, definitely. Just not one of those winters where, gosh, I think it was 3-4 years ago, my kids had a snow day on May 2nd. I don't need that either.
No kidding. Hey, today, Andy, we are very fortunate to have the new park manager for the Nurse Strand Bigwood State Park, Katie Fauché, with us. So welcome, Katie.
Yeah, hi. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for joining us.
Yep. We want to find out all about you, your background, and then, of course, we want to talk about this little gem that we have right south of town here, our Nurse Strand Bigwood State Park.
Some of us literally in our backyards.
Yes, exactly.
Or front yards.
Yeah. Or side yard or whatever. But first, we want to congratulate you.
Yes, thank you.
So when did you get named to the new post?
My first day was July 11th of this past year. So it's been a few months now, almost six, I believe. So settling in nicely.
Yeah. So tell us, what does that mean to get that particular job? Is that a coveted job, having a Nurse Strand Bigwood State Park as the park manager? Is that something you were really after?
It was. It was definitely something on my radar after Elaine Fikema, the previous manager, had retired. There was a little bit of a gap there, about 6 to 8 months or so between. And so, yeah, I kind of had my eye on it. I don't know. Isn't that everybody's dream to be a state park manager?
Sure.
So I was at Frontenac State Park before this
as an assistant
manager. So this was a bump up for me, and it's been a blast so far. I kind of came in at the middle of the busy season. So had to just kind of jump right into everything and try to learn new staff and a new park and operations. So, and then eventually move, because I was commuting for a long time. So,
well, tell us a little bit about what is the process. Do you just suddenly see, hey, there's an opening here, and I put my name in it, or how does the process work here?
Yeah, well, like I said, so I knew it was going to eventually open because Elaine had retired, but the state of Minnesota puts their job openings on their careers website, so you just kind of keep an eye on that and wait for a job posting to become available, and then you hopefully have your resume all shiny so you can apply. And
apply to? Or
the state of Minnesota careers website.
Okay.
And you can break it down by every sort of department that you want or anything. But so I applied, and then of course there's a set of minimum qualifications for every job class. So if you meet the minimum qualifications, then you can move on to the group of people who meet those qualifications. Depending on how many people there are, they might have to sort even farther down to try to keep the candidate pool small. So they might start sorting by they, meaning the hiring officials, preferred qualifications.
And this is all done through the DNR?
Yep. Okay. Yep. It's all done through the DNR in coordination with our HR department. So we sort by preferred qualifications if necessary, and then once we get down to a big enough candidate pool that we can actually interview either a day or two worth of interviews, then you get called in for an interview. You have every DNR job I've had, you have a half an hour to review the questions, and then it's an hour long interview, and then you wait.
And you wait.
And hopefully you get a positive call back saying that they're offering you the position. So
you worked your way up kind of through the system. Is that right?
Yeah. So I got my first internship with the DNR in 2006 at Wild River State Park. And then I moved up to Ely, Minnesota for a while, went to school up there, and I worked for the Forest Service for three seasons doing recreation work out of the Cook office in the Superior National Forest. And then I did wildlife research for the Minnesota DNR up in the Northeast, moose and deer research.
Oh, what did that involve?
Everything. snowshoeing, snowmobiling, four-wheeling out into the woods and... doing
that doesn't really sound like a job.
I know. Doing sampling of whether it be actually live animals or sometimes the not so fun stuff, whether they're deceased or vegetation. Doing all sorts of different types of research, trying to see how the moose and deer populations kind of coexist and different things like that. Some of the diseases and stuff that are affecting them. I did that for a while. I loved it.
You know, I've seen some of the wildlife shows where they go out and tranquilize a large animal and take blood samples. Did you do any of that kind of stuff?
I did, yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. I did do some of that. Most of that I was doing with the deer, and we were taking live samples of deer to see how they cohabitate or don't cohabitate with moose. And we'd collar them. Just a little bit I did that with moose. Otherwise, I was doing more vegetation, looking at where the moose would calve in the spring and seeing if they picked that for a specific reason and kind of trying to track to see if the predators come and get the calves or if they die naturally or how they're surviving.
Well, not getting too far off track here.
Sorry, yeah.
I got a question about the moose. What is your thoughts on why the moose population has dropped so... Because I remember back in the 80s, you know, the moose population was pretty strong. I actually had a chance to go moose hunting in Minnesota.
Right.
And now it just seems like they've dwindled so.
Yeah. I just honestly think it's a perfect storm of multiple factors that are playing into it. You know, obviously everybody's quick to point the finger at wolves. But when you're out there, I saw plenty of moose that would just curl up and die for no reason. And then we go out there and took samples and, you know, you find out they have meningitis and anemia from too many ticks and other tick-related diseases.
Ticks are really tough on moose.
Yeah. So if a moose is covered in deer ticks, they're going to spend more time trying to rub and get these ticks off of them than foraging. And then they just reduce their body size. You know, they start already in the wintertime. They're utilizing a lot of their fat reserves.
Okay.
So if they're not trying to eat to replenish those fat reserves, that's just going to play right into that role of making things harder and harder for them. And then there are different diseases out there. Everybody's seen the videos of the moose going in circles, with the brain worm and stuff. So, and then obviously we've had some changing climate. So it's like a perfect storm. Okay. That's what I would say.
Okay.
I'm not an expert. I was more on the ground. I wasn't doing all the analysis stuff, but.
Did you do much with the wolves up there when you were there or not really?
I didn't personally. Okay. Other than the fun stuff of just collecting scat if we were out there and using that to determine what was in there. But I didn't do anything personally with the wolves. It was mainly the deer and moose cohabitation stuff.
Yeah, I know growing up I led trips out on Isle Royale and back when it was a healthy population of moose and deer. And you could see the populations kind of intertwining where when one was going up, the other was going down. Mm-hmm. And it was before disease and lack of genetic code.
And even with our forest management practices, I know the state was looking into how the state of Maine does some of their forest management practices because they have a pretty healthy moose population. Granted, their whole state is moose habitat, but just seeing how there are differences in the way they manage their forests to the way we'd manage ours up here, moose like a clear cut and then all the fine stuff that grows up after that, you know? And so doing the selective harvest is nice, but when you're looking at it from a species standpoint, some species would prefer to have a clear cut. Mm-hmm. So there's all these different things that are playing into it.
So the way we're kind of managing our forest is more helping the deer out more so than the moose?
Yeah, yeah. I would say there is some of that stuff. And then you got to think that, you know, deer didn't really live up north either years ago, and there were caribou. So there's that whole other dynamic that gets brought into it. So we're changing.
Yeah. So, Katie, why don't you share with our audience your background? Where did you grow up? Are you from Minnesota?
Yeah.
And
I am
some of
from
your
Minnesota. I grew up in the country in Chisago County on a horse ranch.
Oh, okay.
So I'm from just north of the Twin Cities a ways there. And so I've always been a lover of the outdoors. I thought, oh, I want to be a conservation officer because that was the only thing I knew somebody did outside growing up. So I started off going to school for law enforcement and changed that to wilderness management. And I don't know why, but I did. I don't remember what was my decision along the way there, but I guess I didn't want to be in law enforcement anymore. But yeah, so I went to school for wilderness management, did a study abroad for wildlife in South Africa for a little over a month.
Oh, wow. That must have been interesting.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It was amazing.
What a great experience.
It was. I'm still paying off that student loan. Yeah. But, I'm almost there. But yeah, so I did that. And then I ended up finishing up my bachelor's degree at the University of Minnesota in recreation resource management. So pretty much in line with parks. So that's why after working with wildlife for a few years, if I wanted to pursue my career with that, either I needed to go back to school for wildlife or switch careers. And that's when I decided to go back to parks.
Oh, okay.
Worked on the North Shore for a little bit at Tattegooch and Temperance River State Park. Went over to McCarthy Beach over by Hibbing and then Frontenac and now here.
So you've seen a little bit of Minnesota.
Yeah, I have been.
But now you've moved down here?
Yeah, I moved to Faribault in September and slowly getting my feet wet here and learning the town and the community. And believe it or not, this is the 15th home I've lived in Minnesota. So I'm tired of moving. So I hope to stay here for a while.
All right. Well, how's the transition into the new job going for you?
It's good. You know, like with every job, there's a learning curve. On top of that, the DNR is broken down into four regions. And so every region is broken up and operated differently. Each park is operated differently. So there's been a lot of learning and just even getting to know the area. Where do I get this or that? Or if somebody wants directions, just trying to know stuff like that. So it's been good. I've been settling in and I feel like I have a good grasp of what's going on in the park now. Somebody once told me that it takes about 2 years to fully understand an operation. So I've got another year and a half to go before I have all the answers. But
and I assume it's always, you know, a few challenges following somebody else. You know, Elaine was the park manager for a number of years.
Yeah, she was there for a long time.
Yeah. What is Elaine doing?
She is enjoying retirement, traveling a lot, spending time with friends and family, but she's also very active with the Friends of Nurse Strand Bigwoods State Park. So our friends group, we have meetings quite often and they help us raise money. They do different projects around the park. They just did some tree planting. They helped us build a nature play area at the park that was just fully opened in August.
Where did they do some tree planting?
In the picnic area for the most part.
Oh, okay.
Some of our trees in there aren't looking so hot. So they planted 13 trees there. And like I said, the nature play area, we have some events that she helps out with. So we still see a lot of Elaine and we can pick her brain whenever we don't have an answer to something. So
any other new staff? Because I know David, the park technician, David, I'm drawing a blank.
Olson.
David Olson. We've had him on before. I know he moved on. So any other new faces?
Yeah. So we had a lull with filling that position as well. And we had somebody doing a workout of class, but we just had Emily Greger start December 27th. So she's only been there a couple weeks. But she's jumping in and learning the park really well. She came from Forestville Mystery Cave State Park as a interpretive naturalist there, leading cave tours.
Cool.
And then she was also working with the National Park Service on the St. Croix River and worked a little while at William O'Brien State Park up on the St. Croix. And she did a stint at Riverbend down here in Faribault, so doing resource and outreach. So she has a lot of good background, and she is just a very quick learner. I have to keep my to-do list longer because she's just going right through everything I ask. So,
and other park employees?
Most people are laid off for the season right now. We're going to start looking into spring hires here in, I don't know, maybe a few weeks. We can start getting stuff like that done, see if the people who are permanent employees want to be recalled back if they haven't got another position yet. Otherwise, we always have some just temporary positions every season.
I was just going to say, before we go into a break, can you talk a little bit, you know, just kind of refresh our listeners, briefly about the history of the park and some of the things they could see out there and some of the things they should do?
Yeah, so if you haven't been to Nerstrand before, it's pretty unique in the sense that it's one of the few remaining remnants of the Big Woods. I think it's the last. There's only 10% of the Big Woods remaining in Minnesota. And when people started coming in and farming and logging and different stuff, a lot of the woods was lost. And so the Big Woods in Nerstrand, they were separated out into like 5 to 10 acre parcels of woodlots that all the community used. So everybody in the community had their own little 5 or 10 acre lot that they could utilize the wood for fuel or building materials, or sometimes people would just graze their goats and stuff in there.
As a little side note, my grandmother had 3.5 acres in there, and my grandfather had 4 acres.
Yeah.
And it was their wood lot. They would go over in the wintertime and cut wood.
Yeah, for fuel.
That's interesting. All these little small pieces that people owned.
Yeah, if you look at a plat map from back then, it's really cool to see just these little slivers surrounded by big chunks of farmland. Sure. So the local community knew that it was just kind of this gem. Not only is it wooded, but there is Prairie Creek that runs through there. There's a cute little waterfall called Hidden Falls down there. So everybody knew it was a gem, and the community really pooled together to get support from the government and everything to turn it into a state park. And it was finally established as a state park in 1945. So when you come to Nerstrand, you kind of get that feel of the old Big Woods. And a lot of people just kind of feel like they're getting back to their roots when they come down here. And they love going down to the falls, looking at wildlife. We're one of the few places in the whole country that have the Minnesota dwarf trout lily. So in the springtime, we get a ton of people at the park coming down to see that trout lily bloom. It's a federally endangered wildflower. And we have a lot of wildflowers that grow in the state. Or in Nerstrand, I should say. So we get a lot of people down here for that. They love to see that, to photograph them. So we get a group of volunteers that come down and help us with that every spring. And we also have camping. So we have the families that have just made it their tradition to come down to Nerstrand all the time. And the kids, you know, remember growing up going down to the falls and hiking the trails. And yeah, it's just it's a wonderful little gem, and it's right in our backyard here.
And you've got a winter event coming up, I believe.
Yeah. Saturday, February 2nd, we have our annual Candlelight Ski event. Hopefully it'll be a ski, depending on the weather. It might be a hike, but we're busy planning for that, getting supplies prepared. We're still looking for volunteers.
As Andy and me both look straight down.
Yes. So we definitely need a good chunk of volunteers to help us with everything from putting out the candles and lighting to parking, staffing for food.
Have you been out to that, Andy?
No, I never have.
I have.
And you've been there before as somebody who coaches hockey in the winter. Yes, I don't do much else.
Yeah, I know. But it is Just a beautiful evening. And I'm not.
I've seen pictures from it. And it's beautiful.
Yeah. I walk it.
Yeah, I'll walk it too. But I know 2 years ago they had about 750 people show up. Wow. Which was
there were
crazy.
Cars parked out on the road, way down the road. Mm-hmm. I was just amazed.
Yeah. So we're planning for something big, but of course. A
little weather dependent.
Yeah, a little weather dependent. Yep. I know a couple of years ago it was canceled because of freezing rain.
Yeah.
Last year when I was at Frontenac, we had a hike. But it should be good. And if you guys are interested in coming out and getting some free snacks and warming up next to a fire and enjoying some candlelit trails, you should definitely do it. We have a few miles.
All right. Well, you know, we've been talking with Katie Fauché, the park manager from the Nearstrand Bigwood State Park. We are going to go ahead, take a quick break to hear from our sponsor, and when we come back, we'll dive a little more into the park and the future of the Nearstrand Bigwoods. So we'll be right back with you.
Professional Pride Realty is a proud sponsor of Northfield Outdoors on 95 The One. Let the staff and realtors at Professional Pride help you make coming indoors from the outdoors a welcoming experience in the home that's right for you. The realtors at Professional Pride are local and know the Northfield market. Whether it's buying your first home, upgrading from your current home, or purchasing your own slice of the outdoors, let Professional Pride help you every step of the way. To learn more, check them out on Facebook or at ProfessionalPrideRealty.com. Keep enjoying the outdoors and let Professional Pride worry about your indoors.
Well, welcome back. You're listening to Northfield Outdoors on KYMN 95.1, The One, and 1080 AM. We have Katie Fauché, park manager from the Nearstrand Bigwood State Park with us, and we're talking all things about the park. Katie, you recently also had at the park a deer hunt. Mm-hmm. Out there. Can you tell us a little bit about the deer hunt? First, why have a deer hunt in the park?
Yeah, so we do it to help manage the population of deer because we see some negative impacts on our resources, whether it be saplings growing up or some of our wildflowers and stuff like that.
Some of my bird feeders.
Definitely the neighbors, whether they're like you or farmers or something, they see some negative impacts too, because it's not just what the population is in the park, just the population in the overall area.
Sure.
So we decided to have a hunt. We didn't have one last year. Don't ask me why, but I'm pretty sure it has to do with the fact that Elaine and Dave were both in transition out.
Yeah.
So we had one this year. We had 50 hunters, December 1st and 2nd. So muzzleloader only, and it's a lottery hunt. So you have to apply in August, September to be selected for that. And we did get 8 inches of snow on that Saturday. So it was a mess, but we did have 18 deer harvested on Saturday and 3 on Sunday. So not a lot on Sunday, but we still had quite a few people out trying their luck.
And this is a earn a buck. Is that
yes,
correct?
So that is
correct. Can you explain a little bit what that means?
So you can shoot a buck, but you have to shoot a doe first.
Okay.
So you have to have a separate tag for the buck. So a lot of the hunters were saying, oh, I saw a great big buck out there, but I couldn't shoot it.
It's still there.
Yeah. So I think there was a couple like buck fawns, but for the most part, we only had 1 6-pointer on Saturday and 1 8-pointer on Sunday that were taken out of the park. The rest were mainly does.
Andy, you'll get a kick out of this. So that hunt was a Saturday and Sunday. So Sunday morning, we had that snow. I drive out of my driveway, and of course, you know, I'm right inside the park there. And as I turn, I could see cars kind of parked there. There's 3 deer standing in the road by the cars.
Yeah.
And all the hunters are in the woods. And when I came back from town, there was another deer standing right in the road. It's kind of humorous. It's like, I'm not sure where to go, but this seems pretty safe.
Yeah, we're going
to
go where the hunters aren't.
Right.
But Sunday was not the best hunting conditions for those guys.
No, we still had about 29 people show up out of the 50, but some people didn't come out in the morning just because the roads were so bad they came out later on in the day. But it was brutal. It would have been good for tracking.
Yep. So what are the goals? Do you take a deer count? in the wintertime at all?
No, we don't do a deer count. I guess it's kind of based off of the local population of deer, okay, and just kind of what we see on a regular basis. We were kind of aiming for like that 30 to 40 mark for a harvest, but 21 is still pretty good,
yeah,
given the weather conditions.
Yeah.
So we're happy with what we got, and everyone, all the hunters seemed very happy. We had to close the park down for the 2 days, but since it was snowy, we didn't have too many visitors out anyway.
You weren't turning too many people away?
No, no.
But Katie, as a person who actually kind of lives within the boundaries of the state park, and I've always loved this woods. You and I had a conversation a while back. I'm a walker. I like to walk around in there. And I mentioned to you that something seems to be going on in the park with trees, seeing an awful lot of dead trees. And you brought forth some pretty good information. Maybe you can share with us and listeners what's going on in the park there. Is the park in trouble?
I don't know if I would consider it trouble, but there's definitely a change coming. Just so happened that it was my second day on the job, and when I was getting a site visit, and I was going around with the resource specialist, and we kind of noticed that some of the patches of trees that he had noticed before were dead were significantly larger than what he had seen previous to that. So it just kind of spurred off from there. Over that weekend, he went out and looked around a little more. By Monday, he was out with the GPS plotting some of it. We were just noticing these giant stands of dead trees. It's like, okay, well, what's going on?
And it wasn't just one species of tree.
No, it was all age classes, all species of trees, and big pockets of them. So after the resource specialist went out there and did all that and mapped it, we found out that we have about 10 to 12% of our trees are dead or almost dead. The majority of them on the south side of the park, south of the county road there.
And these are not small trees.
No.
These are...
were the big woods. Yeah. They're not
70,
small.
80, 90-year-old trees, 100-year-old trees.
Yeah, absolutely. And you can see that some of them just died this year because the leaves are still on. They're just brown. And the other ones you can see that have been dead for a few years are starting to have green ash growing up under them, and that's it. Just loss of canopy, loss of everything. So what we've teamed up with the state climatologist, Kenny Blumenfeld, and we've been teaming up with foresters and hydrologists and all the experts in the field, because we know what we're seeing, but we want an answer to what's going on. And we've even had aerial imagery and different things going on. And what we came up with looking at precipitation is that there's been a dramatic increase in precipitation, specifically in the last 6 years. But if you look back from 1900 to 1989, and then again from 1990 to present, there's been a 51% increase in precipitation for this area specifically. And the areas of the dying trees are on almost completely flat ground, and there's clay under there. So with all that rain and with no change in topography, the water sits. And with that, the roots can't breathe, and the roots are drowning. So then the trees are all dying.
Because when I've walked around out there, it is all trees. I say, oh, that's an oak tree, dead. Mm-hmm. There's a maple tree, dead. There's a basswood.
Yep.
That's dead. It's there's a hickory that's dead. That just seems so unusual to me that, and it seems like it happened almost overnight.
It did. You can look back at aerial imagery and see that, you know, when I say that the precipitation really spiked in the last 6 years, you can see the trees die in the last 6 years. So, I mean, it's a very rapid change. And now that we know what the problem is, what do we do? So we've been having a lot of meetings associated with that, with all those experts. And we've been talking with some of the U.S. Forest Service and the U of M for some of this stuff as well, trying to figure out what we're going to do. We have some ideas, but we're not sure, you know, whether you let natural succession take place. Do you come in and plant a different species of trees that's not going to be native, because everything that's native is dying, can't survive. So we're trying to hypothesize the future and what to do about it and what steps to take. But yeah, well, we've, from all the research we've done, it's clearly climate change related. The state just released their official climate change page right before Christmas. So it's a web page. So that's on there. And the Nurse Strand story is going to be added in probably the next couple months. So
again, how much of, you said something like 10 to 12% is already dead?
Yep. So that's about and 200 acres.
Will that grow, do you think?
Well, right now, it's all green ash that's growing up, and everyone knows that.
It's not a good time for ash.
No, not with emerald ash borer. And we don't have any in the park right now, emerald ash borer, but it's just a matter of time before it's surrounding other areas. So obviously, ash is not our desired species to be growing in place of all of our dead trees. So that's another reason why we're trying to have these meetings and possibly some test plots. And
so the soil out there, talk a little bit more again. Why is that type of soil kind of creating this problem for the trees?
Yeah, so about, you know, a foot or so, probably 2 feet under the topsoil is clay. Clay just holds on to water. It has a really slow level of infiltration. And when you're getting these 4, 5, 6 inch rains and not a lot of time in between a rain for that clay to dry out, you know, we could get a drought here and there, but unless you're really letting that soil completely dry out, these roots are just drowning. And you can see that as soon as there's a ravine nearby, those trees are fine because they have some horizontal movement of water and they can get some vertical movement of water. But in these other spots, it's just completely flat and the water's just pooling. You can't even walk on some of the trails.
When I notice, because my wife and I bring our daughters out to go hiking all the time, and it'll be 5, 6, 7 days since the last rain. And you get to those low-lying areas, and it's still almost like a marsh on top of the trails.
Yeah, like we had to close down some of the trails because there was 5 inches of standing water. You know, that's going to have implications as we go forward, especially since they're predicting it just to continue getting more damp out and more rainfalls. And we're not getting those nice soaker rains anymore. We're getting those huge rain events all at once, and the soil just can't handle it.
Yeah.
I know when I look out my front window towards the road, it's flat there. The last 3, 4, 5 years, that area has stayed wet all summer, and those trees are dying or dead.
When you and I were talking yesterday about how grass is being replaced by moss.
Yes.
At times there. So.
Yep. Exactly. You know, I have a very small yard as far as grass goes. I haven't had to water that in 15 years.
Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, the falls, the hidden falls at the park, they're doing great, but we also had some flood events just a couple of years ago, and we had to get a lot of materials in to repair the stream banks, and we have the federally endangered Minnesota dwarf trout lily that grows down there right along the stream banks. So, I mean, we're trying to offset those impacts of all the rain, but it's doesn't seem like it's going to be a winning battle necessarily.
You know, Katie, you and I have talked just a little bit. Andy, I'm no expert on climate change, and I'm not sure I totally fully understand the whole science, but I can, with my own eyes, looking just at the Nurse Strand Woods, not only the trees. Well, Katie, I mentioned this to you. When we first moved out there and built, we didn't even have a sump pump put into our house. After a few years, it became obvious we needed to put one in, and it only run in the spring. These last few years, our sump pump runs year-round.
Yeah.
Just driving in before I came in this morning, you know, here it is January, I hear my sump pump running. You know, something has changed out there.
Yeah.
Not necessarily for the good.
No, definitely not. I know you mentioned some migration you've seen, too, when it comes to hunting.
Yeah. As everyone, if they listen to the show, they know that I go out to western Montana to go duck hunting with my son and have for years. I used to go out there October, then early November. The last 5-6 years I've been going out there after Thanksgiving, because the ducks are there yet. They haven't moved on. And in fact, this year, I was just talking to my son here just the other day. He said, oh, yeah, the mallards that have come down have stopped. They just don't have a lot of snow up where we hunt. And so it's affecting even the migration.
Yeah.
You know, as a hunter, I can see
it. Well, you just feel winter's coming later and later. And, yeah.
You have 47 degrees last Friday down here. And it's oh, hello, spring.
So is there really a lot that can be done for the park? I mean, do you need to look at trail changes, things like that?
You know, possibly in the future we might look at something like that. Right now, without really knowing how that's going to spread, the tree mortality, you know, we can look at the topography in the other areas and see that some places might be affected. We might have to close down some of the trails periodically throughout the year when they're just too wet, because all we're going to do is damage them more, you know, if we're out there tromping around in the muck and everything. We are looking into and talking with foresters on trying to get some sort of species that's a little bit more wet tolerant, and testing those out, seeing how they're going to do if we go out and plant some different plots with these new trees, but nothing set in stone yet. We're just kind of still in the process of talking about it and figuring out what our options are and how to move forward. And like I said, we keep going back to all the experts because we're willing to facilitate what they recommend, but we're by no means experts when it comes to this.
Well, and it's an unfortunate, I mean, it's just unfortunate all around, where it'd be great to find some species that are tolerant. But obviously it takes away from the old growth forest when you're planting new non-native species that, you know, even if you bring in some larger trees that are, what, 5 years old compared to the 100-year-old trees that they're replacing?
Yeah, it's definitely, we're going to have a change. It's going to look different regardless, you know?
Yeah.
Those trees are going to take a long time to grow up and become established if we do plant them and they do succeed. Regardless, you're going to see a change in the big woods, and not just the tree species. The understory is going to be different as well. So,
yeah, those areas where you're losing the canopy and stuff, is there a concern about invasive species moving in?
Not you know, yet, like, other than the EAB with the green ash that's going on down there. But I guess we haven't talked about or even considered the fact that I don't think there would be any invasive species right now. I mean, obviously garlic mustard and buckthorn are our two biggest problems at the park. Mainly garlic mustard. Buckthorn, we are somehow very fortunate to not have a whole lot, and I'd like to keep it that way.
Have you guys been able to avoid the wild parsnip?
Yeah.
Yeah, we're not too bad. I see it really bad. Not all to put Goodhue County under the bus, but Goodhue County has a lot.
Yeah. Well, even over in Valley Grove, the north side, as you get past the park a little bit, it's just full of the wild parsnip.
Man, you can drive around and just see like fields of it. It's insane, but we don't have much for that. You know, we have a couple random species that we'll find once in a while, and we get in there and take them out right away.
But that would be a little scary if something like that got a foothold in there.
I would probably cry. Like I said, whether it be wild parsnip or more buckthorn, it's some of those things are almost a losing battle.
Anything new for the future of the park? I mean, we've been talking quite a bit about the effect of climate change, and I'm sure that's going to be one of the major things you're going to be working on. But anything else that make the public aware of?
Yeah, so we're working towards getting a naturalist at the park.
Oh, that'd be great.
It might be on a shorter-term basis for the beginning, but we're going to try to do a lot of outreach with the schools. So trying to have something like that happen where the naturalist can be on during the school season and bring kids out to the park and get them exposed to the outdoors, get them interested at a young age into natural resources. We're always trying to do some different trail work at the park, especially with our wet trails, but other stuff, you know, just like steady maintenance and different stuff like that. But as far as like other big things, maybe I might be blanking out right now. So there's just a lot of different things going on. Some of them are just a lot of little things piling up into something big.
Well, I want to make sure our listeners know too, as we're talking about some of the issues that you're facing, we don't want to paint the park to be this bleak place. It's an amazing place. And I mean, yeah, there are some trails that can get a little damp at time, and there are trails that are 100% beautiful. And I mean, don't let some of the issues that they're trying to overcome discourage you from going out there whenever you get a chance.
And winter, for me, winter time is still one of the great times to really walk the park.
It's so quiet.
Yeah, it is. You hit it right on the head. I love walking around in that park in the wintertime. And even at night, you know, no light pollution. The stars are just bright out there.
Yeah, and we have a great population of barred owls, so you can hear them the time. Yeah, year-round, they're just noisy.
I hear those. Yeah, the coyotes get a little noisy, too,
yes,
out there.
Yes, them, too.
Yeah, we but do they're have pretty cool to listen to.
Yeah. Sorry, I was
going to say. As you were talking about the owls, we go out every summer, you know, as my daughters have gotten older and gotten into teenage years, we find less and less time to go camping, but every year we get out to Nearstrand once and we pick one other state park once. But every time we're in Nearstrand, I go into my turkey hunting bag and grab my owl call, because you can get them to call back to you all night long.
Which we don't necessarily recommend.
And I've never actually done that. I just talked about it. Sorry.
So besides the owls, we do have a small section of prairie, which is great for prairie flowers as well. Yeah. And the north side of the park has a lot of rolling hills and different tributaries into Prairie Creek. So you get a lot of cool ravines, and our fall colors are some of the best in the state.
They really
are.
So
you can't forget that. We're kind of the gem of the south when it comes to fall colors. Everyone's eager to run up to the North Shore, but if you just come south a little ways from the Twin Cities, we have some great fall colors.
Oh, and I will recommend, if you want to go camping to look at the fall colors, you make those reservations really early in the season.
Yeah, we can take reservations 365 days in advance, so definitely make those reservations. And we hardly have any bugs, so that's always a double bonus when it comes to that. You don't really have to worry about your mosquito spray too much.
Yeah, people always ask me, oh, living out there, the mosquitoes must just be terrible. I said, no, they are not. If I can come into town, and mosquitoes are a lot worse here in town than in my backyard.
Mm-hmm.
It's a nice, kind of a nice secret. So maybe
not anymore.
Yeah, right.
Well, we don't have a lot of standing water. I mean, except for on the south side where it's wet. But for the most part, we just have moving water with Prairie Creek and the tributaries to it. So we don't have a big breeding ground for mosquitoes. It's pretty nice for hiking.
Yeah,
definitely.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we have been talking with Katie Fauché, the park manager from the Nearstrand Big Woods State Park, and she's given us a lot of interesting facts on the Big Woods, but we do still have time for Dave's Interesting Facts.
Katie, this is where I get to test out Andy's knowledge on whatever topic. I try to get it close to.
He makes it sound nice. He comes up with very obscure things that nobody would know, so he can make me feel bad.
So I'm going to pick on Andy a little bit. If you happen to know the answer, feel free to shout out.
Like trivia?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. You ready?
Yeah.
Well, this is going to be, we've been talking, you know, about a state park. This is interesting facts about the national parks in America. So it's sort of on topic,
yeah,
Andy.
It's more related than most of your topics.
Okay, I'm going to throw you a real easy softball here.
I bet you're not.
Yes, I am. What was the first national park in the U.S.?
I want to say Yellowstone, but I'm going to probably be wrong.
Yellowstone.
I am going to give that one to you.
All right.
I wanted to shout it, but I was just whispering it into the mic.
It seemed too easy.
And who was the president at that time?
Roosevelt.
Yes. Teddy.
No. Yeah.
No?
No.
Ulysses.
That's what I would have thought.
Ulysses.
Oh, I was wrong, too.
Grant.
All right.
Teddy was influential in, like, Yosemite and stuff like that.
Yeah, all of that. The National Park Service sets aside a lot of land for us to enjoy. Do you know how many, and we're talking national parks, how many acres are part of the national park system?
Katie, go ahead.
Oh, man.
This isn't probably fair to Katie because she's a state.
I don't know. 5 million?
That is incorrect.
7 million.
That higher is still, or lower?
Oh, it's a lot higher.
150 million.
Well, that's a little high. 51 million.
Oh, wow.
About the size of Kansas.
Wow.
Okay, name the only state that is not lucky enough to currently have either a national park or even a national monument.
Rhode Island.
That's what I was going to say.
Well, you both are kind of close, but you're both incorrect. It's Delaware.
That was my second choice.
Huh. Which is kind of strange. Wasn't that the first state created? I think so.
You're off topic, Dave.
Oh, okay. Where is the smallest national park? Not a state park. Smallest national park.
In Washington, D.C.
No.
Hawaii?
Nope. It's Hot Springs National Park in Arkansas. It's only 5,000 acres.
Oh, interesting.
Okay. The biggest?
Yellowstone?
Arcadia. What did you say?
Andy? Yellowstone?
Well, let's start out with name the state.
Ooh, I'm going to switch. I'm going to go with in Alaska.
You are correct.
Came to me late.
Denali?
No.
Great. Sorry, just go.
No.
Mount St. Helens. I don't know. I started hearing you say something.
It's St. Alice National Park. Oh. That's 8.3 million acres.
How
big is
Arcadia?
Bigger than nine states.
Wow.
That's huge.
Which nine states, though?
Oh.
I mean, Rhode Island is pretty small.
I got those answers, but we're out of time, Keith. Sorry.
See, the second you put him on the spot, then we're done.
We got to watch the clock. So.
Hey, there's no clock near you.
Hey, thank you, Katie, for coming in. This has been a great and a lot of great, great information.
Yes, thank you for having me.
Yeah, it was fun. Thank you. As always, we'd like to remind you to tune in next week to On Tap with Corey and Ira and find out how 2019 has been treating them with beer. We'd like to thank Professional Pride Realty for sponsoring Northfield Outdoors. And as always, the show will be archived on kymnradio.net and found under Northfield Outdoors. Thank you to Hayes for updating the Northfield Outdoors Facebook page. Go check it out. We will have some links and some pictures and things from Near Shore and Big Woods. And as always, Dave.
Hey, get out there and enjoy the great outdoors, everyone. Thank you.
Thank you.
This has been Northfield Outdoors with Dave Vesladol and Andy Behem, brought to you by Professional Pride Realty. Join Dave and Andy every other Saturday morning at 11 o'clock right here on 95 The One or streaming at kymnradio.net.